When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Better Call Paul is a production of Lola Media. Say hi, Lola.
Hey, everyone. This is Paul Sarker from Better Call Paul. Just wanted to remind you that the show is intended for entertainment purposes only and is not legal advice. I am not your lawyer unless we separately agree for me to represent you, and the views expressed by Mesh and me are solely our own. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Better Call Paul, the show where we discuss the legal and business side behind the scenes of Hollywood sports and entertainment. I'm your co-host, Paul Sarker, former Marvel lawyer and current Big Law Media attorney.
And I'm your other co-host, Mesh Lakhani. Paul, good to be with you again.
We took a little hiatus and then we had a guest last week, so it's been a couple weeks, Mesh. How's everything going?
Everything's going well, man. Fall is in the air. The weather's actually quite nice. It's a good time. Fall in New York is always the best. I've been doing a ton of park walks. I will say, you know, normally I like to start things off with something I've watched or been watching, and I did take a break. It was a weekday. It was a long day. I was like, you know what? I'm going to go watch Killers of the Flower Moon, the new Martin Scorsese Leo movie.
Was it 4 hours?
Dude, I can't even tell you because I went into the theater and I was really tired and I had some stuff on my mind. I sit down. It's packed. I sit down next to two people. I don't know them, obviously. I'm going there solo. And this movie is so quiet, and I'm quite the fidgeter, and I'm trying to like open my can of club soda and eat some popcorn, and I'm getting so uncomfortable because I'm moving around, and I'm starting to fall asleep. It's a good movie. It's slow. I just got up and left, and I still had
I still had
like 2 hours to go. I watched the first hour and a half and I still had 2 hours to go. And I was like, I can't.
Money's worth because that's like a typical movie length, right? So,
and I felt so
you can catch it on Apple.
That's what I thought. Like, basically, you know, I'll be able to stream this pretty quickly. And I thought about going back, like buying another ticket and then coming in an hour and a half later just to finish the movie. But it's still then another 2-ish hours long. 3.5 hours in a movie theater is a long time.
You know, as a fan, I didn't love The Irishman. I thought it was similar.
Same.
I thought it was like just too plodding. But I don't think Martin Scorsese cares what I think about movies.
Yeah, for sure. Like, it's funny because The Irishman, it's kind of the same feeling. It's like, I'll watch this movie, but I watched it on Netflix over the course of probably 3 days. I just kept pausing.
So listen, the other thing about this weekend is it's Halloween, which I used to love. I remember, especially when I got to law school and being, you know, NYU's down in the village, and that's where the annual Halloween parade, that's where it ends, and it's always so intense and fun. Now, and I mean, as a kid, I remember like always being excited about trick-or-treating because, as you know, my parents were doctors and they wouldn't let me have that much candy during the year, but like that holiday, you know, you had to moderate, but it was basically whatever you wanted. And you know, I just remember being a lot more carefree. It used to be like the only real concern was maybe eating too much candy or maybe getting tainted candy. And now I think it seems less carefree, but it's still a great holiday. A lot of people get dressed up. We are going to be, Jess and I are going to be Kendall and Bad Bunny. And so I think I'm looking forward to it.
That sounds fun. I mean, look, I've never really been a Halloween guy, but I think as I get older, I actually appreciate not necessarily like the party on Halloween. I really like walking around and checking out the decorations and the houses. And we were walking around Brooklyn, around Cobble Hill and Brooklyn Heights. And there were some really cool house decorations, like very advanced. And then the West Village had some really amazing stuff happening. So it's always just a cool thing because I think it's a mix of younger people can do it, older people can do it, kids can do it, everyone enjoys Halloween.
Oh man.
But I'm going to avoid that parade, especially closer to the later evenings, because you know how things can get.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a while since I've even gone to the parade, but it is a fun time. Another thing to watch if you're a basketball fan, NBA season is starting. Baseball's doing the World Series. It's kind of sad for any Phillies fans because they kind of collapsed at the last minute. But one thing I wanted to bring up. So, are you a Hasan Minhaj guy? I feel like I'm a fan. I'm a fan of his. I went to his show in Brooklyn. I asked if he wanted to be on our podcast. He didn't really say yes or no, but he was chatting with me. This was before nice. It was more established. I mean, I'd still love for him to come on. Anyway, the New Yorker did a profile of him a couple weeks ago where they said that he basically embellished his life stories. And there's a lot of fabrication in his stand-up. And the tone of the article is that he's kind of a fraud. And he released a response. I mean, initially after the profile came out, he was like, everything that I said was based in truth in stories from my life. And, you know, to the extent I maybe took some liberties with the details, that's what all comedians do. You know, we are storytellers. We're not necessarily giving like true factual accounts of everything that happened. But there was a lot of blowback that he faced when people were like, oh, he's just like making all this stuff up. And he responded at length this week saying, really in detail, the three stories that the New Yorker said were completely taken out of context. They were actually more grounded in context and that he's not a psycho. And first of all, there's much more important things going on in the world, as you've mentioned, and no one should really be focused on this. But for the record, he wanted to set things straight.
I have two main thoughts about this. I am not the biggest Hasan Minhaj fan. I mean, part of it is we didn't grow up the same way. So for me, there's a lot of like South Asian comedians that represent different parts of South Asian culture. I grew up internationally in Pakistan and Bangladesh. Like, we just grew up a bit differently, but I really appreciate him. I think I appreciate his career. I will say, when the report came out, I was like, oh, that's kind of annoying. Like, he did exaggerate, but I get that he was trying to make certain topics or issues bigger. And I think he had the right intention, but I don't know why the New Yorker cares that much. Like, why did they did like an investigative, like journalism interviewing 20 people around him to basically make him seem like a psychopath? I thought it was a bit much, to be honest.
It seems like it was a bit much. Like, the author maybe had some agenda or definitely took a spin. I mean, that's their job is to generate buzz, right? And to get clicks and to get eyeballs.
Yeah.
And they did that, right? Because that story got picked up all over the place. He's a super famous comedian. And the thing about it is, if you watch him in concert or like you go to his shows, and Jess is a big fan, I guess no secret there. And we saw his King's Jester in Brooklyn when it was being recorded for Netflix. So it was like, instead of the typical like not like 90 minute set, it was like we were there for 4 hours because they did everything over and over again. And the way he tells the jokes and the stories, he does make it seem like it actually is a factual recitation of what happened to him. So
yeah,
I kind of get it, because he's like talking about working out in the gym day after day, setting the story, how brother Eric trapped him, the anthrax envelope, like the emotions that he conveys. I mean, he really does try to sell it as like actually being a truthful story. And so maybe that's part of the humor, but I also think there's something he could take away, which is, if authenticity is something he wants to espouse, then maybe he should be more authentic.
To that point, I actually agree with you, because there's a difference between like, I'm setting up a punchline and this is a comedy joke, and half the time you don't know if that's real or not. Like, I would assume that a lot of like comedians are exaggerating, especially if you have a good bit and you really want to make it funny. Of course you're going to exaggerate. I agree with you that his are more like personal stories, and lying about anthrax is or like leaving out details around that is interesting. But to your point, look, it kind of goes on to something that we're going to talk about later, but it is all about clicks and engagement. And on his side, as well as on the New Yorker side, I think that's kind of the unfortunate thing sometimes when it comes to creating content, is just like the push and need to get attention is by taking these risks like that.
Yeah. I mean, I would say like I'm a fan of stand up and other forms of comedy, and I've seen a lot of acts, and you can sort of tell when someone's making up a story, right? Because of either their demeanor, their tone, their eyes, like the way they carry themselves, the way they set everything up. Like Eddie Murphy or Chris Rock or Kevin Hart. And then you could say, like, when someone is, it seemed like they're leveling with you and they're trying to tug at your heartstrings, and that's the stuff that isn't true, I could see why people would say, okay, well, I feel a little bit misled. But in the end of the day, they are entertainers. They're there to entertain.
It kind of reminds me of like his special homecoming. He's talking about something specifically that happened to him on prom with this girl and her family. It was so specific. So like, why would you make that up? Versus like any one of Dave Chappelle's stories when he's in a club and someone says something to him, you're like, did that happen to him on a Wednesday night or didn't it happen? But either way, it's funny. And right. I don't care if he's making up the story or not.
Right. I mean, it's like sketch comedy, you
I'm
know,
thinking of a very
it's being
specific
made up.
Story.
What, where he played Prince in basketball?
No, that's no, the one where the one where he like he got into a fight at a club and it was, you know, I'd rather not say on this show, but it was pretty funny.
Because I actually was wondering if he did play Prince in basketball.
Well, that was Charlie Murphy. Charlie Murphy said he played Prince in
right.
basketball.
And he's like doing finger rolls and 360s.
But yeah, anyways, look, I think good for him to being, it's always good to like get your side of the story out. I think this is going to blow over. He'll come back, do something great. Let's see what happens with it.
And he's still welcome on the show.
Of course. Of course. That's a given. Let's take a break and we'll come back and talk a little bit about Spider-Man and other things that are happening in the MCU.
You know, right before the break, we were talking about Hasan Minhaj released that 20-minute video to clear his name and state that he didn't truly make things up entirely. And another very famous Hollywood leading man, Jonathan Majors, was charged with assault. He's going to trial November 29th. If you remember in episode 213, we gave the recap of the facts. At the end of March, he was arrested for assault. Allegedly, he hit his girlfriend, Grace Jabari, in the face with an open hand. There was a cut behind her neck. Apparently, it started in an Uber and then it escalated in their apartment and she claimed assault. Then in June, his attorney basically turned the tables and said, actually, she was the aggressor. She was hitting him. And he filed a cross complaint. And the DA's office was basically not swayed by that. They said it didn't seem like there was a lot of merit to that. And in domestic violence cases, we talked about this, how a lot often it's he said, she said, and there's a lot of exceptions to the evidence rules because so few women are willing to testify in situations like this. And basically, if they recant their story, once a charge is filed, the authorities have to go through with it because they often feel like they need to rescind what they said because they want the relationship to continue. They don't want it to be the end of the relationship. And so that's a cycle that is very problematic. Anyway, what the prosecutor's office said is that in domestic violence cases, it's not common that someone would 3 months after the initial act claim self-defense. Usually they would say it right then and there at the initial arraignment.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Wait 3 months.
Yeah.
It's going to trial November 29th.
I've been kind of following loosely, but I saw the video. There was a video that came out with her with some friends and he was coming and then this guy was trying to like, get at him. Well, no, there's a video of her at a club that his lawyer, Priya Chaudhary, said that there's clearly no evidence of her being injured. She's at this club. She's ordering drinks. She's dancing. She's talking to the DJ. Obviously, we don't know in terms of timing. That could have been before. It could have been after. There was another video of surveillance. I think this is what they're trying to get a hold of them on the street that she's like completely fine. And I thought I saw something like this where he's walking and she's with a group of people and some guy like tries to go after him. So, but I started Googling that and it didn't come up and it's not mentioned in any of these things. So I'm assuming that's not really part of it. But the interesting thing is he is in Loki season 2, which just kicked off. It's already in episode 3 and he's very much a part of the series.
Question is whether it was shot before March, right? Which I suspect it was, and therefore they're not going to recast him and redo the whole show because that was probably in the can before this all happened. I think with respect to Avengers 5 and 6, you know, he's supposed to be Kang, and Marvel, I don't think they've definitively said one way or another whether they would recast or not, but if he's convicted in trial, it would be tough for them, I think, to make the decision to move forward with him as Kang. I mean, it would just, even if logistically he didn't have to do time and was able to appear, they may, from a PR perspective, not want to move forward with him. I would say in June, when he filed the cross complaint, he also tried to get the charges dismissed. And the DA, the Manhattan DA, Alvin Bragg, said, there's enough here. where we think this needs to go to trial. And so I know that there's that video of her in the club looking like she's fine, yes, partying, talking to the DJ. The question is, was that right after his camp is saying that was like a couple hours after this incident was supposed to have happened, or that same weekend? I don't really get it. I mean, I know domestic violence, there's no place for it in society. And so if what is alleged to have happened did happen, I think he should face some consequences. But I would also say, if it didn't happen, it's a really unfortunate thing for him, because he was maybe the premier leading young like black actor in America, and his career, I mean, he's a rising star. His career was taking off. And if he is found guilty, then I don't think he has a career.
No, for sure. And but then, if, you know, and on the other side, if he's found not guilty, it's usually maybe some type of redemption story there. We'll see what happens in trial. I'm just reading this thing that says all this evidence, according to TMZ, including the full surveillance footage videos, has been submitted to the DA in Manhattan. His lawyers have also said that the witnesses, including the cab driver, will testify, who apparently saw that Jonathan Majors didn't put his hands on her. So I guess we will find out when this trial starts. And to your point about Loki and the filming, from what I understand, he actually met Jabari in London when they were shooting Loki.
It was a recent relationship then,
I guess. But, you know, who knows when they started, you know, when they start filming, et cetera. Right.
Yeah, it could be a year, year and a half from shooting to release. I guess we don't have to rehash what was in 213, but it is very unfortunate. On a more positive note, staying in the MCU, or the Marvel Universe at least, Spider-Man 2 dropped last week, the video game for PlayStation 5, and it had the best initial 24 hours of any PlayStation game. Sold 2.5 million copies at between $70 and $80 a pop. That's almost $200 million in its first 24 hours. And it's also being... Yeah, it's being described by fans and critics as the best Spider-Man game ever.
It looks freaking insane. Here's the thing with these AAA publishers. So the companies that produce these like big hits, like a Spider-Man game or a Halo game or The Last of Us, I mean, they spend hundreds of millions of dollars developing these games and marketing them, and it takes years to make. But obviously, they do make a lot of money. 24 hours making $200 million, I mean, you probably made your money back. And then on top of that, whatever additional content gets released with it.
I don't know. I mean, $200 million, I don't know if that's your money back fully in that first day. I'd be curious to see.
Okay, maybe not the full amount. The P&L.
Yeah, because, you know, so you have Sony's taking a cut. There's three studios. There's PlayStation Studios, Marvel Games, and Insomniac Games. And Insomniac, I think, is what made it. And, you know, I was taking the S train to Times Square a couple weeks ago, and I saw that they completely did the Times Square takeover. That's not cheap. So I'm sure they paid a bunch in marketing. That's true. The cost to develop. Once you factor in the royalties that are going to, you know, Marvel. And
that's a good point.
I think they probably
that's
need to make more than $200 million.
But good start.
Yeah, certainly a great start. I don't think it's the same type of curve.
Yes, you're right. And it's not the same type of curve, because usually what you want with these games is that you want... like there's a certain amount of playtime that you want for them. So in this case, for Spider-Man's sake, it's about... I think the actual gameplay is like 15 hours, and then with all the side content, it's about 40 hours. Some games have like 100 to 200 hours. So 40 game, from what I read, 40 hours is kind of in line. You pay 70, 80 bucks, you get 40 hours. I'm sure people want more, but I'm sure people will have fun just like doing Spider-Man stuff through the world, and that's kind of part of it. It's an open world. Just real quick, Insomniac Games is part of PlayStation Studios. They acquired the studio back in 2019. And so the interesting thing about this game is it's a follow-up. There's three games in the series. The first one was Spider-Man. The second one was Spider-Man Miles Morales. And then this one is Spider-Man 2, which includes both Spider-Man and Miles Morales. And Venom, of course, is in this game. You can see through TikTok alone, TikTok and YouTube, tons of gameplay. Paul, this is actually how I experience games. Like, I don't play these games because it ends up being a huge time suck, and I end up becoming obsessed with it. I'm also not the best player in the world, and I get frustrated. So I will just watch the gameplay.
Watch the people who are really good.
Yeah, and I'll just watch them play the game, and then I get my fix and watch the storylines and stuff, especially for something like Spider-Man. But it is pretty cool. Like, it looks very cool.
It does.
Yeah, good for them. It's supposed to be like one of the highest rated games.
One minor point is that I think they mixed up the Cuban and Puerto Rican flags in Miles Morales' room because he's Puerto Rican and there's a Cuban flag. But I think they fixed it. They released an update to fix that. Let's take a quick break and jump back with an ad revenue update and maybe one of the coolest in-person advertising executions of all time. So, Mesh, you were in Vegas a couple weeks ago for your cousin's 40th, right, if I remember correctly? Did you happen to check out the Sphere?
You know, we were all talking about it when we were out there, and everyone was like, the Sphere, the Sphere, the Sphere. It was it's at the Venetian Resorts, which you could see from where we were when we would go to the Encore. I didn't get to see it that well, but it is freaking, this thing is so freaking cool. It's MSG's Sphere. It's a $2.3 billion project that has 1.2 million LED lights that are shaped like hockey pucks.
Well, each light has 48 diodes to collectively display 256 million colors. So 256 million colors for each of the 1.2 million LEDs. That means like the most insane visuals you could probably imagine. I was curious if you were there up close, or if you went to an event there, is it like Epcot size? Is it bigger? Is it smaller?
I didn't get to see it up in person, but I imagine it's like a more like a basketball arena, maybe a little bit smaller than a basketball arena.
So like 20,000 seats.
So the Sphere has 18,600 seats, actually, Paul. So you nailed it. It can hold 18,000 people when seated, 20,000 people when standing. Just to give some dimensions, it's 366 feet tall, 516 feet wide. I mean, and the cool thing about the visual is it's from the outside and then, of course, from the inside. So, you know, this thing got kicked off with U2's 25-show residency, and who better to do a concert at the Sphere than U2, who's known for these incredible concerts.
I mean, I don't know if I would have picked U2, but I feel like if you're going for, like, the older crowd, maybe you go with U2. Yeah, that's just me as a fan, not to be critical of U2. I mean,
totally,
obviously
U2
has some great, but I'm sure there's some Swifties out there that were wondering why she didn't get the first slot, or some reggaeton fans wondering why Bad.
She probably doesn't want to do a residency because she'll make more money on her.
Taylor Swift became a billionaire. Tour. We should mention that. So shout out to her. Well, here's the thing. So the Sphere cost $2.3 billion, massive cost overruns. They started construction in 2019. It got delayed by the pandemic. It's, as you said, MSG, and they own and operate Madison Square Garden in New York, which is a world-class venue. The experience that you get from concerts, and we saw Rage Against the Machine at MSG, the way they do, you know, the bars, the concessions, the merch, getting in and out, it's all very seamless. And so, you know, top of the market in terms of experience. Apparently, it's out there on the internet that their advertising rates are $450,000 a day to advertise on the exterior, $650,000 for a week. And they're saying that they can generate 4.7 million impressions
a
day.
Killer.
So concerts aside, immersive experiences aside, even if you are just a brand, and the NBA was the first brand to use the exterior of the Sphere. They were marketing their league in the summer. It's a one-of-a-kind destination. Visually, there's nothing like it. In fact, it was on Time's Best Inventions of 2023. You know, great for them. If you're going to spend that kind of money, $2.3 billion, you're building a trophy property. And to think about it, I remember when I went to I haven't been to Vegas in a couple of years, but when I went as a kid, I think the Bellagio was mind-blowing. That was that was a $1 billion property.
Right.
I think Wynn and Encore are like $2 billion. The Sphere costs as much as those huge, massive resorts, and it's just an arena. So it's got to be mind-blowing.
This is where I really love the whole innovation thing when it comes to like an experience. You want people to pay up for an experience. And then even on the ad and brand side, it's not like you're just going to slap your logo on the Sphere. You got to get creative with it, because the more you get creative with this big Sphere that is showcasing some digital art piece for your ad, you're going to get not only more views, you're going to get more people putting that up on social, more people sharing it with their friends, more people driving by. It is just, it's like, what does the billboard of the future look like? I mean, this is from another planet. So I think it's cool. Like, there is a video that went viral of the Sphere having like a face on it, like a smiley face on it, and the eyes are moving. and someone was on their plane taking a video of it from above, and then the eyes immediately looked at the plane, so it looks like it was looking at the person. It's just little stuff like that. You're just like, whoa, this is like, and that of course goes viral. Everyone knows what this fear is again. So then some company is going to sit there and be like, yeah, let's run like a 4-week campaign and pay up to do this. I mean, right now it's probably a good deal to be paying this little when you have like a $1 billion ad budget.
And we talked about this. If you're the first to build the VR headset or the flying car or whatever, I mean, there's no real set P&L that you can follow. You can estimate as much as you want, but if you are a pioneer in a space, you're going to have to spend a lot to create something. And you don't want to underspend and create a shoddy product, because that's sort of the worst thing. So they're a first mover in this kind of space, this immersive entertainment advertising area, arena. It's not the first arena, obviously, but it is going to have to really stand the test of time, and it's not the kind of thing they wanted to not do perfectly. And so I kudos to them, and it's also in a great place, right? It's in Vegas. People go to Vegas. They're not necessarily worried about pinching pennies. They're like, oh, how often am I going to be here? Let me go to a show. Let me spend $600 to go see U2 or whatever it is. So even if you're a brand and you want to advertise there, that's a different analysis. But even if you're a fan of U2 and you want to see something like that you're not going to be able to see anywhere else, go to the Sphere, right?
100%. I mean, I think Dana White of the UFC was saying he can't wait to do an event at the Sphere. And I think everyone's thinking about, for some special event, you're going to want it to be at the Sphere. And that doesn't even include the types of new shows that we're going to see that's not just music. Obviously, Darren Aronofsky, the director, has got Postcard from Earth that's going to be after U2's residency, which he directed specifically for the way the Sphere is built to be some encompassing visual experience. So I'm excited about that stuff. Like, that's pretty cool.
And speaking of, so the Sphere, concerts, shows, advertising. And advertising's having a resurgence. Just to round out the show, Q3 closed recently, so a lot of companies released earnings. Mesh, you're a business finance guy. The economy at large grew at 4.9%, the GDP, and that exceeded expectations. People were expecting a recession, and 5% growth is something the U.S. does not do often, right? Because we have a huge economy to begin with, so to grow 5% in a quarter, it's very, very fast. So a lot of companies did really well. A handful of companies did incredibly well, especially in advertising. And advertising is a market that had hit a little bit of a lull the past year, year and a half. So Facebook, Google, Amazon all crushed it this last quarter. I think Amazon's numbers were up 26%. Google's were up 12%. And Facebook, I don't think they released specifically what their ads did, but I know their profit was up. Their revenue and profit were way up. That's a good thing, right? This show relies on advertising, and a lot of businesses see the value of advertising. It's good to see that digital advertising is rebounding.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're finding is that everyone who tried to really focus on subscriptions has run into the problem that exists with subscriptions in general as a business. It's that it hits a wall, and there's a lot of churn, especially when you're not able to have a differentiated enough product. And I think when it comes to like entertainment specifically, that becomes harder because content ends up being like, it's just competition. So people just switch. There's nothing really enough for you to be like, you need to be on here and we're the best. I think the only thing is really, that's why people do sports deals. And I'm sure you could agree with that, is that that is something that allows you to keep people on there and differentiates your product. And everyone seems to think that, well, we got to introduce advertising again because we have to make more money. And it seems to be the only way for us to do this. And I think that's just what most of these like content platform businesses are discovering, is that they just have to get smarter about how they introduce advertising here.
Well, so, and this is all publicly reported. So Amazon made $12 billion in ad revenue in this quarter. Google made $8 billion. And that's a lot of money. That's not chump change. And the other thing about advertising...
Well, it was YouTube specifically that made $8 billion.
Yeah, because YouTube, sorry. YouTube made, and analysts were only expecting 7.8. So YouTube crushed it in advertising, which is, like we said, a 12% increase. And I do a fair amount of this advertising legal work. And the impact of technology in terms of targeting ads, DAI, switching things out, and the level of analytics that you can get if you're a brand in terms of who's buying your product and how to market your product to people who are likely to consume it, that growth in how sophisticated advertising has gotten is really out of control. And that's why I think digital advertising, you know, they're just in some ways just scratching the surface of what they can do. Now, some people are like, oh, I don't want to get inundated by ads. But if they're ads that are sort of curated to you for products that you're likely to want to buy or things you may already need but not know it, I think that's when it seems less maybe grating. If you're watching television and you're just bombarded by ads for things that you're not interested in, I get it. But if you're on your phone and you're seeing ads, or if you're listening to Better Call Paul and you get ads for products that are in your day-to-day, you know, like things that you would regularly purchase, I think it can be really helpful.
No, for sure. I think that's right. And I mean, I think we'll see that continuing. I guess they'll be investing more and more into that technology and into those strategies. But again, still a long way for streamers to really get out of the amount of money they spent setting these things up. So we'll see what happens there.
I was reading, this was a couple of weeks ago, there are now TV manufacturers that will give you a free TV just to get a billboard into your house.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know if it was a pilot program, but they'll give you a smart TV valued at like $300 or $400 or $500, like a 55-inch TV, 4K, just because they want to be able to sell ads in that inventory. And it's like the cost of the technology is going down and down and down. And it's like, it's so valuable, the real estate. And so, you know, I'll take a TV. I'll watch some ads.
I'll take a TV and I'll quote unquote watch some ads, i.e. stop paying attention, go on my phone or mute the TV and then wait for the show to come
Your
back.
Phone's going to send you ads too.
That's also true. You can't get away from it.
And I like the ads. And I will say, growing up as a kid, just shout out to my dad, and I'm sure he's listening, he would always stop and like comment on the funny ads. I think when people go, you know, really try to make a funny ad, like the Patrick Mahomes ads on TV, I think are really funny.
Yeah.
And yeah, it doesn't have to be annoying.
I appreciate ads that are like I would enjoy. And I think this is why everyone tunes into the Super Bowl. And I don't know why they just don't do this year round. But I mean, I remember 90s ads. For some reason, I just used to like them. I used to like things up, cereal ads or whatever it was about. They're always like somewhat entertaining. The style was cool. I enjoyed those ads. It feels like everyone plays it too safe these days.
Yeah, I think it's there's a lot of things. I think once you start seeing the same ad over and over, I think that's also kind of a pressure point for some people. I think if it's creative, funny, sort of original, I think people are going to like it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So I guess that it's, I mean, a good segue into, you know, get more creative on how to do ads like the Sphere is doing. So we'll be curious to see in the next couple quarters how the numbers change with these streaming services.
Yeah, we'll see.
All right, Paul. Well, great episode as always. Good to be back together. That's our show for this week, folks. Make sure you're subscribed to the podcast, Apple, Spotify, wherever you choose to listen. Share it with your friends. Check us out on Better Call Paul, the podcast, Instagram, TikTok. Follow me on Twitter at @MeshLakhani.
Better Call Paul is produced and edited by Valentino Rivera and assistant producer Lisa Sanders. Have a great week.
Thanks, everyone.